If you love without evoking love in return, if through the vital... If you love without evoking love in return. If through the vital expression of yourself as a loving person, you fail to become a loved person, then your love is important. It is a misfortune. Karl Marx, Private Property and Communism. So, Maharaj, could you make...
That was the whole problem, is that Karl Marx felt unloved. Just see.
So, Maharaj, could you make a bridge from communism to Vaishnavism?
His mother used to say, Karl, you're always talking about money, but how about making a little? Your mom always knows what's wrong with you, with your system. So what was that? Read it
the
again.
The whole question, okay.
Oh, yeah.
If you love without evoking love in return, if through the vital expression...
You mean the other, you're loving, but the other person doesn't feel the necessity of loving back.
Yes, it's without evoking love in return, yeah. If through the vital...
But I'm saying it's the fault of that person or the other person? Or it's not clear?
Not clear.
Okay.
Maybe later, but yeah. Still. If through the vital expression of yourself as a loving person, you fail to become a loved person, then your love is impotent. It is a misfortune.
No. Sorry, Carl. You can love without being loved in return. Ask any parent. All right, that went over not too well. But there's one agreeing. It happens. It always happens. When I was, my mother was not known for her sense of humor, but I could make her laugh sometimes. And when I said to her, oh, you know, there's a blues song by B.B. King that has this line that says, ain't no one in this world loves me but my mama. And sometimes I think she could be jiving me too. And my mother burst out laughing uncontrollably. I went, So, not to belabor the point, but it is possible to love without being returned. In fact, someone wrote a book, a scholar wrote a book on this called Love and Friendship. First of all, I should predicate these remarks on the concept we're talking about so-called love in the objective world, which from a spiritual point of view is not love proper. Right? So we're dealing in this on this side of the equation. So this scholar wrote a book, Love and Friendship, and he made an interesting point. He said, in, how shall we say it? He titled the book Love and Friendship. You know what is unrequited love. Yeah, that was a love by definition that cannot be reciprocated. Right. On one side. So I'm paraphrasing, his premise was that in love, you can love somebody without them loving you in return. He said, but in friendship, it has to be mutual. Simple, but that's his point. But it began by saying that you could love someone without them loving you in return. And the so-called unrequited love that was the subject matter of a certain type of literature, and particularly, maybe the most common stereotype was the knight who has this love for the queen that can never be truly reciprocated, and he goes off and fights on her behalf and is willing to risk his life, but she's the wife of the king, so it will be an unrequited love. We will say that along the lines of virtue is its own reward. That it's okay to love if it's not, what was the word used? Began with an E? No, what was it?
Impotent.
No. If the first line of this...
If you love without evoking love.
I said it began with an E, without evoking love. Yeah. Again, in a world of people with misconceived notions of self, what is this love based upon on either side? It's theoretical, because you don't have two real substantial agents. One of Prabhupada's favorite slokas from the Bhagavatam, Yasyatma Buddhi Kunape Tridatu Ke Swadid Kalatra Dishuboma Ijudi Yatirta Buddhi Shalilena Karhachid Janeshu Abhigyeshu Saeva Gokara. Yasyatma Buddhi, those whose concept of self is Tridhatu means the three elements. Their concept of who they are and the object of their love and affection is Tridhatu, means the three elements, mucus, bile, air. Kalatradi. Kalatra-adi means wife, family, children, its relatives. It's all based on this. Boma-ijadi, they think the world, the land they were born in is worshipable. It's another name for nationalism, wherever it is. And I was surprised to find, wherever I went in the world, however heavenly the environment or hellish it was, it was worshipped by the local people for no other reason than they were born there. So it just was assumed. Boma ijadi yad tirta buddhisha, and they go to the holy places for an objective experience, not the subjective aspect of what's actually there, the substantial saints that represent the spiritual substance of that place. It's just, it's spiritual tourism. Janeshu abhigeshu sa eva gokara. I mean, it's very strong language in the Bhagavatam saying, such persons are no better than asses or cows. Right? So the ass is, you know, always, you know, the butt of so many jokes and offensive sayings. Only Trivikram Maharaj has affection for them. Now, he has ass, donkey, I forget exactly, but what was his name? Jurema. He went somewhere and saw him and just said, you know, with the farmer, said, I'd like to buy them from the guy. He said, okay, gave him some money, put him on his pickup truck, came back to the ashram. So he has very broad love and affection for the whole animation. But so we can understand in saying it's an ass-like mentality. But why cow? It says no better. Gokara. Go means cow. And we think, well, cows almost inevitably, invariably, in devotional discussions are praiseworthy. But not in this case. No. One reason is that when the cow calves as a baby, sometimes the baby's calf dies. But they can bring the milkman, they can bring a dead calf to a cow, because the system before technology was the calf comes, it gets the milk flowed, and you tie the calf on the side, and then, so once the calf, out of affection for the calf, the milk flow of the mother begins. Then I've seen this. I used to have a service in ISKCON Temple on Albert Road to oversee the milking of a cow every morning. The Gowal would come with the cow, and he had a little calf. And then, and they have the rope for tying the leg, and they'd have the calf start sucking the udder, and then they'd pull the calf away, and then he'd sit there with the bucket. So they know this trick that if a cow has calved, even if the baby is dead, they can bring the dead calf in front of the mother, and she's licking it, and out of love of and affection, her milk will begin to flow. These are pretty terse, intense examples given in the Bhagavatam. They're not sentimental. That's what they mean. So they're saying, that love, well, you're saying, well, there, her love and affection is toward a dead body. That's the point. All this talk about love and affection and being reciprocated, its target are just animated bodies. It's not towards what is animating the body, but just the body that's being animated. No Atma Darshan, or seeing of the soul self. And that may seem harsh, but if, as the sloka says, if your conception of self is bodily based, and body can mean include the subtle body, so not only the physical body, but the subtle body, mind, intellect, ego. It's false. There's nothing real there. And we live in a world where women, particularly, they're judged in terms of their physical appearance. That's how people decide to be so-called affectionate towards them, is the basis of their physical appearance. So it's not like we're just making this stuff up or plucking it out of thin air. It's on the internet every single day, at every single moment. It's a worldwide international problem. I didn't make this up. Anyone who doubts it, just go online and open your eyes and see. And it's, why are women being tortured? It's on the basis of their value being assessed in terms of their physical appearance. So one woman, I forget which wave of feminism she belongs to, forgive me, but she wrote a book called The Beauty Myth. And we see how arbitrary it is in one sense when they do retrospectives on what was considered beautiful during one age, and sometimes the people of the present age, they're shocked to see that was a standard of beauty at another time, or whatever it might be, indicating that it's arbitrary. It's not an absolute standard of beauty, if there is such a thing. And we contend that there is. There is absolute beauty in the absolute personality of Godhead. Guru Maharaj reappropriated the phrase, reality the beautiful, in relation to Krishna conception. So, Pambhakti yoga paribhavita hritsaroja ase shutekshita pato nanunata pungsang. Ase shutekshita pato. Take the path of seeing by hearing, not what make your assessment on objective visualization, but subjective visualization, right? Going towards Atma, the Atma plane. And people being uneducated about that think that there's no possibility for affection, love and affection in that plane. Enlightenment is seen as some kind of monotonous state where one is mainly relieved from the suffering of the negative world. So being in a neutral position is like, whew, finished with that. Now, and that's a so-called happiness. And if we want to give it some credence, in the language of Veda and Puranic literature, Brahmananda, the happiness, generic spiritual happiness, just realizing the essential spiritual nature of everything, and there's a type of anandam or happiness from that. Right. How much so? No. When with Ramante Yogino Anante Satyarananda Chiratmani. But I think in another one. Brahmananda Bhavedesha Chet Paradha Gunikrita Naiti Bhakti Sukhambodhe Paramanu Tulamapi. It's a sloka quoted by Rupa Goswami, where he's saying, if you take that, first of all, he's saying, the happiness of Brahmananda, is so great that those experiencing that have no desire for mundane erotic pleasure, which is generally taken to be the highest form of material and most intense form of material pleasure, right? Let me say, they have no they're beyond that. They've overcome that. So let me think, well, that's very great then. Must be very great, wonderful, ecstatic. But Rupa Goswami says, if you take that pleasure and multiply it a trillionfold, it won't be equal to an atomic fraction of the pleasure derived from Krishna consciousness. So that's quite an advertisement. It should at least pique one's imagination, curiosity. Could that possibly be true? Is there a plane which is like that? Right. No. As I've mentioned, the narrative of the objective world at present runs along these lines. There's a trillion stars. Among them, one planet, one blue planet, the Earth planet, has living beings and conscious living beings, and particularly human beings represent the conscious elite. Right? And those human beings, on a good day, if they get lucky, they experience a drop of pleasure or happiness. That's the scenario. So the objective world is virtually unlimited within that, and practically on a molecule, there's a molecule of consciousness, a plane of consciousness, molecular by comparison. Right? And in that conscious world, anandam or happiness, you might experience a drop seasonally on a good day, lucky, it's at all of that. So then anandam is the least, consciousness somewhat greater than that, right? And the objective world is virtually unlimited. This is what we're being told, right? This is what we've swallowed wholesale. Or as Guru Maharaj says elsewhere, the ghost of Darwin is still haunting us. And what is the Krishna conscious perspective? The inverse. This is, as Guru Maharaj says, the objective world is like an iceberg floating in an ocean of consciousness. It's the least. Consciousness is a vast substance, and what's even greater than that? Anandam, happiness or pleasure. You say, really? Well, what is the nature of the infinite? Anandamayobhyasat in the Vedanta, saying the infinite, the nature of the infinite is anandam. He is constituted of anandam. It is not something he seeks to achieve. Right? He's in a nirananda state and then trying to move from nirananda to ananda by some means. No, he is anandam. The ultimate reality is love and happiness, beauty, charm, and sweetness. And what? Personified. Those things don't exist as impersonal, primordial elements. Right. No, consciousness cannot be divorced of personality, actually. Right. Neither can love or happiness. Right. They're not independent elements. We're told, anandamayobhya, he is full of ananda by nature. Ishvara Parama Krishna, the opening declaration of the Brahma Sangita. God, the Supreme God, Ishvara means God. Ishvara Parama, the Supreme God is Krishna. Those are the first three words of the Brahma Sangita. It gets right to the point. The Supreme God is Krishna. What is his nature? Satchidananda. He's eternal, omniscient, and anandam. There's not an omni word for ananda, is there? He's omni-ananda. Omni-anandam. Full of ecstatic joy. And as Guru Maharaj would say, not like we're talking about an ocean of joy, ananda nidhi, saying not a static ocean, as if like, oh, static ocean of joy, but a dynamic ocean of joy. So it's saying that, and so what is it? Sat chit anandam vigraha. He's the personification of eternality, omniscience, and ecstasy. That's the nature of the infinite. Right. So, and everything coming from him has that potential. So how is it realized? In this world, we try to acquire, control, consume things that are lower than us. That means the objective world, because we're basically innately subjective agents. Mam eva ansa jiva loke, jiva bhuta sanatana, being Krishna's ansas, or parts, we're of a similar nature. That means we have a satchitananda potential. Right? Finite in magnitude, but connect with the infinite. So, or the option to offer ourselves and dedication to that which is not only higher than us, but infinitely higher than us. Right. So there are various palatable ways to describe that. So most often we hear like, you know, servant of the Lord. Even that doesn't sound too good in modern context. Nobody wants to be a servant. Right. Say executive assistant. Executive assistant to the infinite on your business card. See, what we hear words like servant. And go, ooh, no. Serfs? Servants? But Guru Maharaj, as if to press our ontological buttons, just put it out there bluntly in saying, slave, and not even directly slave, slave of the slave. So look at the fine print before you sign on. Slave of the slave of the slave. Like I said, Dasi means slave girl. You can look it up in your Monet Williams dictionary. That's what Dasi means. Slave girl. No, if you say female, slave girl is what it means. But not directly. Slave of the, you will be the slave of the slave of the slave girl. Right? So all of this, makes you sweat, your hands shaky, sweating. This can't be a realistic proposal. But Guru Maharaj comes to our aid and our rescue to help us understand that when he says that. Gives an example when Gandhi needed an executive assistant, servant, slave girl. When the position, the opening was made known in India, he said, who volunteered but the highest men in India, the wealthiest, the most educated, the upper echelon of Indian society, they were volunteering for that position. Why? Thinking that he's so great, Mahatma, he's so great, if I have even the least connection with him, how beneficial that will be for me. If I, carry his bag or do his laundry or whatever, any connection with him, I will improve. However, apparently menial. So the so-called greatest men were volunteering for that position. So Guru Maharaj is making the point when we think, oh, well, that's Mahatma Gandhi. Or something, oh, I'd like to have been Einstein's assistant. Or someone said, oh, I knew Stephen Hawking. Or so they think, oh, these people are so great. If I could just be around them, any excuse to be around them would be a thrill and I would improve. So when it comes to so-called great people of this world, we can easily understand that. But Guru Maharaj's point is, then how much more is it applicable to have this sort of relationship with the infinite? And not only that, but we hear Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita, ye yatam mam prapadyante tam stataiva bhajamyaham. As they approach me, the kind of love and affection they give to me, I reciprocate that. So unthinkable things, then the other half of the equation is you become Krishna's slave, Krishna becomes the slave of the devotee. That part they didn't stick around to hear. Krishna is the slave of his devotees. Shri Krishna Karshini Chasa. That's what Rupa Goswami says when he's defining the characteristics of pure devotion. Kleshagni Subhada Moksha Laguta Krit Sandra Ananda Visheshatma. Shri Krishna Karshini Chasa. Krishna, it's interesting this word selection. Because Krishna, means magnetic attraction, except here the magnetism is Satchidananda, beauty, charm, sweetness, personified to the infinite degree. But that Krishna, who has been described as all attractive and irresistible, he is attracted to devotion, irresistibly drawn in attraction to the devotion in the heart of a devotee, who in this context can be represented as finite. Although we don't like to think of the super servitors and finite, but just for a relative comparison. So that means even in the case of jiva. So Krishna bhakti rasa is such a valuable substance, attractive, it is irresistible to Krishna. He who is all attractive is attracted to this. One might ask, what is he attracted to? Love, love proper, prem. And how much so? Even a drop of that substance in the heart of a divine servitor is enough to make the infinite come under the control of the finite. So we hear the prayers of Kunti Devi. Gopyadade Twayi Kritaga Siddhamatabad Te Dashashu Kalilanjana Sambramaksham. What is her meditation? What comes to her mind? She's saying, when I think of that, Yad Bibeti Swayam Bayam Apanak Sangsritim Gauram Yannama Vivashoganam, that who is feared by fear personified, how he's running from his mother. He's done something naughty. And she's in her mind, she sees this image of Mother Yasoda running after Krishna with a, you know, a, what they call a switch, a little stick. And Krishna's running from his mother, and he's like that. But the kajal means black mascara. Those who have been to India, see, they still put mascara, kajal, on the eyes of children, boys and girls, little boys and girls. They look very cute. We saw them at Kusum Sarovara. It's little girls like them, and they have black mascara on their eyes. And they do it to little boys too, up to a certain age. They say it's good for your eyes. They say all kinds of things. But so Krishna has that. And think lotus eyes, big eyelashes. Very full, fluffy. And he's running and crying because he's afraid of Mother Yasoda. One author, when she was being interviewed, Jhumpa Lahiri, she said, they asked her, what were her fears in life? And she said that when her children grow up, they would no longer be afraid of her. She wouldn't even, you know, when they're young, they're afraid, and then she's going to reach this age where they're no longer afraid. But here, Krishna is afraid of Ma Yashoda. And he's running and crying, and the tears are washing the mascara from his lotus eyes and making it run on his divinely beautiful face. So, and it looks very beautiful to Kunti Devi, to see how the mascara is streaming down the face of Krishna with the tears, and Mother Yasoda is running after him. She's saying, that image is enchanting my mind. The infinite here, running like that, out of fear of his mother. She said, who is feared by fear personified. As we told the time when they brought something from Devapoli and they're trying to give Gurudev some prasadam, and normally the Mat sends some paramanna to the Srinagapoli and then it's brought back. But at a non-scheduled time, some other time, some devotees had been there, and just a word of advice, don't try to purify your guru. That's not a good strategy. So they're bringing something. That's okay. It's the, you know, they live here. They died for a good cause. They went to the light and they, you know, they got the light of the Bhagavat, so they're doing fine. They want to give this to Gurudev, and he looked at me like, and he said, well, he said, we are afraid of Nisringadev, so we'll take, you know, like, they brought some. He said, but Guru Maharaj will not take. Some devotee goes out and comes back, but he said, Guru Maharaj won't take. And he said, because Nisringadev is afraid of Guru Maharaj. So if someone said, well, how can he say that? How can you support that? With the prayers of Queen Kunti. Yad bibeti swayambhayam, whose fear personified is afraid of him, is running from Mother Yasoda because of that devotional intensity. But it's a very sweet thing. Remember, everything there is made of sweetness. That's the nature of that world. Janmad yasya yataha adi rasa is the original mukya, principal rasa, the root rasa, and everything, vatsalya, sakya, dasya, shanta, come from there. It contains all of them. Each one does not contain that, but that contains the elements of all the other rasas, being it's the origin of all of them. They exist to support Madhura Rasa, not independently. It's a very beautiful arrangement. So, when devotion is assessed, recognized, identified, where the infinite comes under the control of the finite. When Mahaprabhu was touring South India, and he comes to the town where he meets the man who is apparently illiterate, but he's been told by his guru, read Bhagavad Gita every day. And everyone's making fun of him. He can't say the words properly, read properly, but they're mocking him, but he's thinking, my guru told me to do it. I'm somehow trying to execute the order of my guru. And Mahaprabhu comes upon this scene, see the people mocking him. He's there going on to, earnestly, trying to obey the order of Sri Guru. And this situation becomes known to Mahaprabhu, and he said, but I see also that, I notice also sometimes you're crying while you're attempting to read Bhagavad Gita. Why is that? And he said, well, he said, when I think of how, you know, what is that? Senayor Ubayor Madhye Stap Rataya Yuta, I forget that song, but when Arjuna says to Krishna, place my chariot between the two armies, you know, of generals. And when I think how sweet is that, that Krishna, he's the driver of Arjuna. Not that Arjuna is the driver of Krishna. Arjuna, place my chariot between the two armies. How much love, how great is that, how much love and affection he has for his devotee to take a subordinate position. And Mahaprabhu was saying, he is the real scholar of Bhagavad Gita. Bhaktosi me sakha cheti. The Gita Rahasya, this is the secret of Bhagavad Gita. Devotion, it's about devotion. He's saying, so he's understood the essence. And where is devotion identified? When the Supreme Lord, when the infinite comes under the control of the finite. So then Guru Maharaj makes the natural sequential question. Who can be entrusted with that? What's sort of so-called finite can be entrusted to control the infinite. Someone who's out of curiosity, they're interested in spiritual things, or they've come to get something. No, who are wholly one with Krishna. There's no difference between what they would want and what Krishna would want. That's the person who can be entrusted with that type of responsibility, right? To control the infinite. He's controlled by love and affection, the ultimate reality. They'll think like, well, no, we're sending a deep probe into space, and then we have the Hadron Collider, we're working on it, and too bad Stephen Hawking's gone, because he was going to tell us the answer. I mean, really. This is laugh out loud kind of stuff. And that mindset prohibits one from saying, and they will think this is laugh out loud, but I think it's a sweet laugh. We say, no, the central conception of the infinite can be controlled by love and affection, not by your instruments or your algorithms, or you're going to put a bunch of computers together and they're going to figure it all out for you. How that is, it's shocking. The central conception of the infinite can be controlled by love and affection. Even Karl Marx would have to appreciate this. As Nietzsche said, if I were to believe in God, he would have to be a good dancer. Yeah. Natabara. Krishna. The ultimate reality is dancing. And very nicely. Beautifully. Movement enhanced with beauty is dance. That's what dance is. Movement enhanced with beauty, as speech enhanced with beauty, is song. So the infinite comes under the control of the finite. Remember one of the first lectures we ever saw Srila Prabhupada give in Los Angeles? He's on the Vyasasana, and we're all sitting there, mesmer, and Prabhupada said, you know, how the pure devotees, they possess Krishna in his hand, and he said, and he can give him to you. And it's as if we saw Krishna come out of Srila Prabhupada's palm. So, Bejur Mukunda Parivim Shrutibir Bhimigyam. Uddhava, who's certified by Krishna, na tathapriyatama atma yonir na shankara, na cha sankarsana naiva sankarsana naiva sri naiva atma chayatabhavan. No one is more dear to me than Uddhava, not Atmabhu Brahma, not Shankar Shiv, Shiva Shankar, not Sankarshan, not Lakshmi. In fact, I am not as dear to myself as Uddhava is. And Sanatana Goswami points out in Brihad Bhagavatamritam, quoting that sloka, which appears there twice like zenith point, climax, and it says, he says that actually he means devotee, as Uddhava specifically, but also the devotee, because we know if we take the devotional conception of the highest position, that comes from Uddhava. But he's allowing Uddhava to make that statement. Asamaho Charanarenu jushama hangshyam Vrindavane kimapi gumalato sadinam Yaddushtajam svajanam arjapatam chihitva Bejur mukunda parivim shrutibir vimrigyam. After seeing, Krishna said, take this letter to Radharani and Brajagopis and give them some hope. They're drowning in an ocean of separation from me. But it's more than one purpose. That's part of it, to assuage the grief of separation in the hearts of the Brajagopis with some encouraging and hopeful words from Krishna. But also what he wants to Uddhava to be an eyewitness to is the sort of devotion that they have. That's why, take this letter. And then Uddhava will see what comes, not from only from the hearts of the Brajagopis, he will see the divine madness, Mahabhav Swarupini Radha Thakurani, the Brahmar Gita will come out. Her mad talks to the bumblebee. This high estates of divine madness that are also shared by Mahaprabhu and the Gambhir in his final times. Separation zenith points. And having witnessed that and the greatness of their love and affection for Krishna, this comes from his heart. Asamaho charanarenu jishamaha. His aspiration, I want to the dust from the lotus feet of the Brajagopis, which they will never give to me, because they're respectful girls, teenage girls, and he's this exalted personality. So he's saying, that, you know, I can't say, could you give me some, that doesn't work, you know, and that's not going to happen, but he's thinking. So if I was Brajalata, that's why it says, Vrindavane kimapi guma lata, guma lata oshut means leaf, flower, something on the soil of Vrindavan. Then when the Brajagopis and their Chintamani gem decorated lotus feet are moving in the soil of Vrindavan, some of the dust from their holy lotus feet would come upon my head like an abhishek, thereby consecrating my existence. That's his aspiration. And he's saying, and what the Vedas are only indicating in a general sense, they've got in the palm of their hand. They own Krishna. Copyright, trademark, patent, they own Krishna. To what extent? Only they can distribute Krishna on this, in the highest sense. It's their prerogative. They own him. Because that they are slave girls. And he's the slave of the slave girls. So when Krishna sees the type, and he's the object of the love and affection of the Brajagopis, although he's omniscient, he can't estimate how great it is. It's puzzling him. Who is omniscient cannot estimate how great is their love and affection. So he says, Napareham Nirvaja Samyujam Sloka, that he's saying, now you're making me break my promise I made in Bhagavad Gita. In Bhagavad Gita, I said, as they surrender to me, then I reciprocate that level of surrender. You become my slave, I become your slave. And just as a sidebar, that's not fair. That's not an equitable arrangement, actually. Because you say, well, there's total self-giving on both sides. Yeah, but one's finite, one's infinite. Right? So for the infinite, they give himself wholly, unthinkable, yet Sri Krishna Karshini Chasa. So Krishna is saying, I promised in Bhagavad Gita this sort of equitable arrangement, and now I find it has to be broken because the sort of love that you have in your hearts, I can't, it's too great. Even giving myself is not enough. So in Guru Maharaj's words, he said, so there, what is he saying? Let virtue be its own reward. Back to the original premise. That's here, so-called love that is not being reciprocated has turned into something extraordinary. He's saying, because I don't have enough to give you, and I'm the infinite. So then what? Are they sad to hear that? And what Guru Maharaj says, the payback from Krishna comes as Mahaprabhu. Where he descends in the world to proclaim the glories of their love to everyone, which is otherwise known as the Krishna Consciousness Movement. Sureshanam Durgam Gati Ati Shayeno Panishadam Muninam Sarva Pranatam Pratalinam Madhurima Vinir Yasha Premno Pashu Palam Bujad, I forget the rest. But Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. No. Apidushor Yashatipatam. In the Chaitanyastakam of Rupa Goswami, Guru Maharaj says here what is alluded to at the Brajagopi saying, like, oh, look what happened to Krishna. He's become our canvasser, the canvasser of our mistress. Who is their mistress? Srimati Radharani. Now Krishna is telling the world the glories of Radhar Mahima Prema Rasasima. The glories of the love of Srimati Radharani and the limits of Krishna Prem. He wants everyone to know that and also to come in connection with that. Namo Mahavaranaya, Krishna Prema Pradayate. Because someone's saying, like, he's giving love of himself. No, but it's Mahaprabhu, Guru Rupa Harim Gauram Radha Ruchi Ruchavritam. In the mood of Radharani, wants everyone to have Krishna Prem. And what kind of Krishna Prem? Her kind, the best, of which there is no higher kind. Never been given before. Anarpita charim chirat koranayavatirna kalo samarpayatam unatojvala rasam swabhakti sriyam haripurata sundarjuti kadamba sandipita sadahridaya spuratu kandare spuratu vasachinandana. How beautiful is that? So we conclude with him giving Krishna Prem, distributing Krishna Prem to others. And as he himself says, what is that? Krishna Prem, Jambu Nadahim. Guru would say, Krishna Prem is not a thing of this world. Jambu Nadahim means there are mythical rivers of gold on the heavenly planets. Like we hear, there's a place where there are elephant-sized mangoes. And they fall from the trees, but they're mainly liquid. And when they hit the ground, then they make rivers of mango juice, and then the banks turn into gold. Different things are described. So there are mythical rivers of gold in the heavenly world. That's beyond our experience here. But what's being said is, Krishna Prem is not a thing of this world. It's not a thing of the objective world. But it is the thing in the subjective world. And we are innately subjective agents, trying to transition from being riveted to objective world, external world, objective notions of self, toward the pure subjective plane, Atma, Paramatma world, Om, Bhur, Bhuva, Svat, Tat, Savitur, Varenyam, that worshipable plane that is illumined not by the sun. Gurumayi said, "What? Without consciousness, the sun doesn't, you know, illumine anything. And there's no observable illumination without an observer." Right. So, what really is it? It's Atma that allows you to see. Atma is the sun, and Paramatma, the supreme sun, of which Jiva is Kiran, ray, and the Paramatma world. It is revealed, the world, Atma, Atma Gyan Parigyanamayo. And it's Varenyam, worshipable, not consumable. How do you worship? By self-giving and self-offering. And what is the end result of that? The infinite coming under the control of the finite out of love and affection. So Krishna comes as Mahaprabhu to canvass on behalf of Radharani and Brajagopis how great they are and how great is their love, and they are the givers of Krishna Prem. Guru Rupa of Krishna is Gauranga. And who is Gauranga? Radha Ruchi Ruchavritam. He's covered. Why is he called the hidden Chana avatar? Because he's covered by the heart and halo of Radharani, and he's not coming as God, but as the supreme devotee. He's hidden his godness in the background, enveloped by the heart and halo of Srimati Radharani. And Nityananda's going door to door, falling the people's feet, begging them, Bhaja Gauranga, Kaha Gauranga, Laha Gauranga Nam. Worship Gauranga, take the name of Gauranga, sing about Gauranga, everything Gauranga, Gauranga, Gauranga. And Mahaprabhu said, go tell everyone about Krishna. And that's what he's saying. Do you know Krishna came as Gauranga? Because he knows, yata yata gaura padara vinde vinde te bhaktim krita punya rasi tata tatot sarputi hridya kasmat radha padamboja sudamburasi. At the lotus feet of Gauranga, you'll get Krishna. Navadvip's the entrance to Vrindavan, Gauralila is the entrance to Krishna Lila, Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan is the entrance into the Rasa Lila. Those who are Sukritivan, Sumedasa, refined theistic intellect, this will resonate with them. And what will happen as a consequence of exclusively dedicating oneself to the lotus feet of Guru and Gauranga? Radha Padamboja Sudamburasi. Or is it the Radha Rasa Shudhanidhi begins to flow in the heart? And what do? They spring out of the soil of Vrindavan in service to the holy lotus feet of Srimati Radharani, Radha Dasyam. Hare Krishna.